Welcome to A Day in the Why, a podcast where I talk with fascinating folks about the jobs they've held, the things they've learned, and how well those line up with their values and goals. You may just learn something, but I hope you'll at least laugh along with us as we dive into the mistakes we've made, the lessons we've learned, and the secrets behind how we got where we are today and where we're going tomorrow. Welcome to A Day in the Why, episode number 2, where we explore what our guests do for a living, their road to that role, and how that aligns with their values and goals. Welcome to the show, Julie. I'm really excited we get together today because I enjoy seeing people in person, and we've been in a quarantine for a year and a half. I followed your career since we met at Scripps Networks a long time ago. That goes through like running and beer bash charity events and even the Bijou. I thought it would be fun to pick your brain because one can only pick up so much in shouted conversations across a backyard or across a theater. So I really appreciate you making time to share some insights with me and our listeners about what you're doing right now, how you got there, and where you're headed. Can you start us off with an overview of what you're doing right now?
Well, right now I am operating my own business. So my name's Julie Goss, and I am the owner of J. Goss Digital. Now, what I do with that is I am a SEO expert, and I work with businesses to optimize their websites, both for search engines and for general use. I also do a lot of blogging for various
people. So when you say various people and SEO, like, can you give me a size or an estimate of like the size of your clientele? Are you dealing business with thousands of people or hundreds of companies, or do you have, you know, two or three big clients that do all the heavy lifting with you, or what does that look like?
I have one really big client, well, who provides most of my income right now. For them, I'm doing mostly paid search with some just marketing, general consultation, and SEO work for their website. Mostly, I work with marketing firms, and they hire me to do work for their clients. So I'm not working directly with most customers, the end customers. I am basically doing work for marketing firms as a...
It's like a subcontractor, right?
Yeah, subcontractor. Yes, as a consultant subcontractor.
I'm moving towards that model myself. I've got an aerial imaging business. And rather than going out and trying to find a bunch of, say, residential customers who need pictures of their house and videos from the sky, etc., I'm trying to approach much larger companies who they themselves contract out. For example, a company called Yates Construction is behind the Amazon warehouse project out by the airport. And so I can just deal with that one construction company on this and presumably, you know, many future jobs. And that's only one customer. And it's so much easier to deal with logistically than having, you know, 50 customers.
Absolutely. Plus, you don't have to do all the searching for new clients and trying to network and get your name out there and then end up with clients that you don't necessarily want. So by working through larger companies for as subcontractor for their clients, they already vet the clients. Plus, you don't always have to talk to them when face to face, so you have a little bit of a cushion.
And you know that the check's going to arrive because the checks have consistently arrived, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. That is a plus as well.
So what would you say your favorite element of this phase of your career is?
The variety. I've been working with, like I said, these marketing firms, and you know their clientele is all over the place. So I spent 20 years working in corporate America for Scripps Networks, as you mentioned, and that was primarily for, you know, lifestyle programming. And now I'm doing SEO and keyword research and even writing blog posts for clients as varied as agile consulting to an attorney to builders. And so the variety of topics that I get to research is very wide, and I've learned a lot.
Learning is a passion of mine too. It sounds like it is for you as well.
To a degree, I do believe you should always keep learning. You should strive to learn something new every day if you can. Now, I'm not one to study, which keeps me from returning to school, right? But I enjoy reading a lot of magazine articles or online articles about these different topics and these different industries. And that's what's fun to learn, is how people do things a little bit differently, just depending on who their customers are and what their goals are.
So the flip side of that last question is, if you could minimize or maybe like surgically remove some aspect of what it is you're doing now, what would that be? What's I guess, your least favorite thing, or the least efficient thing, you know, the most boring, et cetera?
One thing that I've struggled to do after coming from, you know, an entire career working for other people and having set hours and set days of the week is not spending all of my time working, feeling like I'm always on call, that I'm always working, that even a day off isn't really a day off, and I'm feeling guilty for not checking my email or not writing that article, and not realizing the people I'm working for don't work on Saturday and Sunday most of the time either, or Memorial Day or any other holiday. So that's part of the current job that I have, that I've given myself, that I struggle to control, is overworking and not ever quitting.
Which is funny, because the complaint that many employers had in the early days when we were asking to work from home, hey, can I work from home one day a week or one day a week, a month even? The protest was, no, you know, we can't be sure you're going to be active and working and staying on the clock, staying busy, et cetera. Where the reality is, a lot of us are doing what you just described. We're actually putting in more time, more energy than we should, certainly more than we would at a typical, you know, 40-hour a week gig. So it's interesting that the reality is completely different than the fears that were portrayed by employers for a long time.
Absolutely. And even when I was working for Scripps, from time to time, I would work at home for whatever reason. And I felt guilty if I wasn't working 8 hours. You know, when I was actually in the office, I'd spend time, you know, chatting with my coworkers or leaving my desk for lunch or, you know, just walking around the building to try to wake up right in the middle of the day. But when I was working from home, I felt really guilty for not being in the office. So I always felt like I needed to really put in my time. And I think I probably worked harder when I was at home than I did when I was actually at my desk.
Well, thanks for sharing all that, Julie. I hadn't realized that you were more of a subcontractor. In my mind, I guess the story I built around your solo business was that you were going out actively and finding, you know, drumming up business with a bunch of different businesses and then sort of pitching your services and then coming back and doing the content strategy for a bunch of individual customers.
Well, I started out that way. So pre-COVID, you know, I was going to events where I would do a lot of networking and passing out cards and talking to people. And I did get a lot more individual companies with whom I was working. Where I've pivoted in the past year and a half is to these marketing companies. And I mean, everything with these guys has been word of mouth. The companies are owned by people I've been friends with for years, or a neighbor, or people I've worked with before. And so I was able to form these relationships and build them over the past year and a half, where, you know, you can't really network. It's harder to go out and solicit business unless you're going to do some advertising. I'm a sole proprietor, so I don't really have the bandwidth to deal with hundreds of customers. I provide very personalized service and very hands-on. So yeah, I didn't really want to advertise widely and just have to field a lot of clients that just weren't a good fit or didn't want to pay me what I was wanting to charge. So it was just a lot easier to settle into working with these larger firms and letting them find the clients. So you were not incorrect in thinking that I was going out finding clients, because I started out that way. But COVID, you know, put the world on pause. And so all of us probably had a chance to step back and figure out, hey, this is exactly what I want to do, rather than just running headlong into something and doing it because you think that's the way you have to do it.
Now that we kind of got an idea of what you're doing now, I'd like to take a step back and figure out kind of how you got there. What led you there? So what would you say are the most influential stepping stones in your life that kind of put you on that path? Maybe that's influence of family or friends, or the first job you had over the summer, life experiences, eureka moments.
Well, as I mentioned, worked for Scripps Networks, which, for those who don't know, that's HGTV, Food Network, and a few other cable channels, or at least it was. Now it's been bought by Discovery. After 20 years of working there, after Discovery bought it, they allowed some of the longtime employees to step away. I always made the joke that after 20 years, they were going to have to pay me to leave, so Discovery did. So that is what got me out of corporate America. I had a health scare a year before that that kind of helped me reevaluate priorities, and after Discovery laid me off, I realized that I didn't need to just lurch headlong into another job. I didn't have to run around trying to find another employer if I could just employ myself. I had a lot of experience. I had a good nest egg cushion from my severance package, and my husband has a great job with great insurance. And so I decided to just take the leap into entrepreneurship and see how it went. And so far, so good.
So, Julie, I have to confess, I really don't know how a content strategy business works. Content strategies is one of the many Venn circles in a description of what user experience is, for example. But I really don't know what a focus on content strategy looks like from a business perspective. Can you give us a little bit of insight into that?
What I do for business first is a content overview. So I look at their website and I determine how it performs in search engines. I look at the keywords that they're using on the site and what keywords they should be using on their site that pertain to their business. And I do a lot of keyword research around that. I use a couple of tools that monitor Google searches. So that tells me how people are referring to their business or to an industry that they're related to. I also ask for the competitors, the people they consider their competitors. And I do an overview of websites of the competitors, you know, how they perform in searches, you know, what keywords are being used, how is their site set up for user focus, so the usability of their website. And I also look at who their actual competitors are online, because sometimes who you think your competitors are or who your competitors are in real life are different than the ones that compete with you for keywords and for searches on Google and other search engines. So I pull who your top competitors are in search engines as well and do a same sort of overview for them. And then at the end of all of this research, I put together a report that shows you where you are, shows you opportunities that you have, and gives you a comparison with these other websites and what they're doing that well and what you can incorporate into your site and sometimes what you're doing better than they are. And then I wrap that all up with a list of recommendations and next steps. Now, sometimes that will include a content strategy from a high level, which means, you know, you don't have these three buckets of content on your website that you really need to serve your customers. That your customers are looking for this information and you're not giving it to them. Or it can be, you know, every one of your web pages is missing an SEO tag, which is the title that shows up in the blue links in a Google search. So, you know, you need to make these changes to your website. Or it can be a blog calendar. So, you know, these are the things that people are actively searching in your industry right now. You can look at Google Trends and see that purple people eaters might be trending for someone's business, and they don't have anything on their website about that. So you would put that in the blog calendar and say, hey, you need to get something up about this right now, and then blast it out to all of your social networks to take advantage of this spike in interest.
Now, is that just to get the content on the site, or by virtue of putting it on the site and then blasting it out on the social media networks, you're just creating a lot of road signs that end up bringing the eyeballs?
Yes, it's both, because, you know, anything that you do on your website as far as naturally getting people searching for content to your site is not going to be an immediate thing. So you put the content that you need on your website, and you have to use channels like social media, like newsletters. If you're sending newsletters, you can do paid search ads to get people to those pages. Eventually Google will catch up, but yes, you have to actively push this content out in one way or another to get people immediately looking at it.
And typically, how much of your advice do they take?
It depends. You know, sometimes it's a lot. It's a lot of work. So, you know, I've had some come back and say, hey, this is all great. Do it for me. I've had some that say, oh, this is all great, but I just can't do it at all. And then most of them are in between those two things. So, okay. You know, I'll end up doing some of the work and then they'll take it over. You know, I've had one or two that's done almost everything or is at least in the process of doing everything that I've suggested. It's, you know, I had to learn early on to temper my expectations. It's not always going to work out the way that, you know, I've planned it out for these customers. So
you can lead a horse to water.
Right? True. That's true. And, you know, people have a lot of reasons to do and to not do certain things. You know, sometimes it's a time constraint. Sometimes it's, you know, they love the way their website looks, no matter whether it's difficult to navigate or difficult to manage. They don't want to change anything about it because they like how it looks. So you can't really argue with that. At least you can't past a point. So, you know, there are a lot of things that go into the decision. You know, having worked in corporate, you had, you know, more of a team behind you and a team mentality. So things got done. You would see the things you suggested actually happen because you usually had a lot of input from other people on the team. And we were the team who were controlling what's going on. When you have a customer whose team you're not really on, you're an auxiliary player, they may not take your advice.
Yeah, because you don't know what their capabilities are. Absolutely. As an organization or what their priorities are outside of this narrow slice that you have insight into. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And everybody's so different, you know, they're just different. And they may think that what they want is their site optimized and to get all this traffic from Google, but they're really busy enough. When they realize how much work it's going to take to get this extra users to their websites and maybe potentially extra business, they realize, oh my gosh, well, you know, if it's going to take this much work to do it, I don't have time to do that much work. So perhaps I don't have enough time for that many new customers anyways.
So selfishly, I'm going to pick your brain.
Okay.
I have a aerial imaging company. Now I've kind of segued into doing more industrial work, construction projects, job sites, things like that. If I were to come to you and say, Julie, I need help getting more big customers. I don't want any more mom and pops. I need big customers. How can you help me do that?
So that can be an issue because you don't always have the people who are making the big decisions in the big companies aren't always sitting on Google, you know, looking for this help. You know, they are more likely to, you know, ask for referrals from other people and to see, you know, they'll see the work on somebody else's website and like it and then ask, you know, who did this. So, you know, one of the things, as far as your website is concerned, you know, you want to make sure that you're communicating clearly the audience you are targeting. So, you know, when you write for your website and the examples that you use on your website should very much be tailored to these bigger clients. And, you know, you don't want to put weddings up on your website and that sort of thing. You want to make sure that, you know, everything is pointing to these folks. And then you want to make sure that the content that you develop for the site, that you're communicating it in all the places that these big decision makers might be. LinkedIn being, you know, the main one. You know, I think that none of us are utilizing LinkedIn to its full capability. I think it's a really good place to connect with folks. I also would look at maybe Facebook groups that are industry focused and see about joining them. But another thing is if you can get the customers that you have where your work is being displayed on their websites, to give you a shout out, to give you a link, because those links back to your site are going to be valuable in a couple of ways. You know, one is if somebody sees your work and likes it, they can get to you through that link. The other way is, you know, Google, part of their algorithm is the number of links back to a website or count it as votes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, these people are voting that this business does a really good job with their aerial photography. And so, you know, the more links you get back from that sort of client, the better it's going to look to Google's algorithm.
So it's kind of social validation.
Yes.
Okay. More people that say this guy does his job well, more likely he is that he actually does his job well.
Yes.
Okay. Right, well, thank you. Well, that's two stepping stones. I feel like that can't be a complete picture in what got you here. So I'm going to dig a little deeper. Okay. Let's go back to when you were growing up. I mean, you went to UT.
I did.
You went to UT for marketing, I think.
I did.
So I guess early on, what were the things that led you to think, I want to be in marketing and I'm going to go to UT for that?
Well, it really didn't come in that order. So I grew up on a farm. And my daddy owned the farm. And so, you know, I saw him working for himself, which may have been part of the influence when I decided to do my own thing after corporate America. Decided to go to UT because it was UT. And, you know, I'm a Vol fan, so it was a perfect fit. I went into the university with the idea that I wanted to become an accountant because I liked math. Quickly found out I did not want to become an accountant because I did not like math that much. So I cycled through a few different business focused topics, and I just felt a better fit with marketing. It was a little less solid, allowed a little bit more creativity. The irony in all of it is that when I was in school, there was no such thing as online, really. It just was, things were just getting started with the internet. And where I ended up using marketing was in online marketing. So the principles that I learned at UT helped guide me with some of the big picture decisions. But the specifics of what online marketing is, and which is part of what I do, didn't really exist at the time.
So a lot of what you learn in school doesn't really carry forward, but perhaps the primary marketing principles do.
Correct. Okay. That is correct. That, you know, primary people are people, and they respond to messages in much of the same way now as they did then. It's just the way you convey the messaging is different. Mm-hmm. Completely different.
Now, I know you, during your 20 years at Scripps, you probably didn't have a lot of end user FaceTime because the users themselves weren't really specific. I guess you had completely internal customers, right?
No, not necessarily. Probably the last 10 years was like that, but I did spend time managing their message boards and answering webmaster emails. So I heard a lot from customers for a while back when that was a thing. You know, of course, when social media started taking over your original communication channels with customers, it changed. But I used to hear from customers quite often. It was interesting.
So pre-social media, there was kind of an infrastructure there within Scripps and presumably lots of, you know, media and communication companies that was there solely to be the interface between viewers, consumers, and then the company.
Yes, there was. We also did online chats. So we would have one of the hosts of the shows answering questions live online. The viewers could send in. Now, it wasn't a video. Back then, it wasn't video. It involved me on one end talking to the host and reading the questions, and then someone else sitting at a desk across from me who would type in the answers that the host would give.
Oh, okay.
So it was, that was also very interesting to hear what the viewers would ask.
So there was a little bit of vetting there.
There was a lot of vetting in some cases, but yes.
It's, okay. I worked, one of the roles I had at Scripps myself was in ad operations. Mm-hmm. And I recall working with the team that sort of phased that out on a lot of their sweepstakes and communication, things like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting how social media really changed so many industries.
It really is, and how it continues to change. It's I think that COVID amplified social media, amplified its influence, and changed the way that companies communicate with their customers and their users through social. I think that it's really probably stepped up the importance of it.
So I know that you also spent some time at Kinko's.
I did. Probably some of the people listening don't remember what Kinko's was. It's now a FedEx office. But yes, I spent a good part of my early career there. I managed one of the stores and worked in their graphic design department. And what that taught me was that I did not want to work in retail again if I did not have to.
Fair enough. I did a little stint at a Barnes & Noble coffee shop way, way, way back in the day. The team that trained me kind of just gave me a straight up warning. They're like, this is what we tell everybody when they start. You don't want to be between someone and their coffee. Unfortunately, that's the job you're signing up for. So Be prepared.
Yes, it's definitely it's a talent to be able to work with customers face to face. You have to have a skill set, and I learned at Kinko's that that's not necessarily my skill set.
So you know how, but not a preference.
Correct. Yeah. I can do it, and it's okay. It takes a lot out of me, so I'm much better online.
I'll always have a soft spot in my heart for Kinko's. It was the place that art school students went to scan our work, to make copies of source material, to size something up. So yes. If I've got a still life, but I need it five times the size, well, I can go into Kinko's and I can blow it up and then blow it up again and again and again. And then I've got 16 8x10 sheets of paper that I can glue together to then transfer to my gigantic canvas that's due tomorrow.
Yeah. Right.
And it's a good thing Kinko's is open 24 hours, isn't it?
It is. It was really, that part of it was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed working with artists in particular when they would come in and I could help them bring their creation to life, help them get what they created into the medium that they needed to present it. And that was really a neat thing to do.
Mm-hmm. So I want to switch gears a little bit now and talk about values and goals. A lot of times in real life, we don't really examine our values and goals actively, but I think it's pretty helpful to do that once in a while to see if yours have changed over time and whether you're really using your time at work and play and at home in a way that's in alignment with those values. Could you sum up some of the values that you hold most dear? Ideally, a small handful. You may have 50, but a small handful of those, and be as general or as specific as you're comfortable with.
There are three characteristics and personality traits that I hold closest to me. One is honesty. I try not to mislead people. I try to be honest with everyone, sometimes brutally. I value people's time, so I want to be very dependable. I always keep my word. I try to be on time. I try to meet my deadlines in 95-100% of the time if possible. And then the third is I don't quit. It was really my mother's voice in my head that tells me, don't quit. Just keep on going. We've kind of talked about some of that and how I use it in my work. I want to be dependable. That's why I find myself working when I probably shouldn't. I always want to hit my deadlines, which is also sometimes why I find myself working when I shouldn't. Personally, I'm one of those crazy people that runs distances. Now, I don't run huge distances, but I'm a half marathoner.
I would beg to differ. I think a half marathon is a pretty huge distance.
Well, 13.1 miles, that 0.1 will get you. But I've run 11 as of Saturday. That was my 11th half marathon. And I have to admit, Saturday was hard. It was the hardest half I've done. A part of that's because I hadn't trained as well. Part of it because it was just hilly. I mean, it was very, very hilly. And I wanted to quit. In fact, the volunteer started asking me at about mile 6, "You want me to call someone for you? No. Are you okay? Can I get you?" I was like, no. So Uber is my friend. I can call Uber if I need to. It's on my watch. It's great. And I really wanted to. And then there's that voice in my head that sounds like my mother that says, "Don't quit." At this point, delirious enough to be talking to myself. I'm like, but I really want to quit. I don't want to run anymore. Doesn't matter if you don't want to run. Do it anyway. That's sort of the guiding principle of my life is, okay, doesn't matter if you don't want to. Do it anyway. You can't stop moving forward. You can't stop. You have to just keep on going.
I've been guilty of saying yes, of agreeing to do something, to opt into something, to jump onto a project, to join a new group, et cetera, et cetera. And sometimes it just gets out of hand, right? It's consuming too much of my time. Mm-hmm. So with this firmly rooted don't quit attitude, do you ever have trouble disengaging when you should disengage?
Yes. No is one of my favorite words. And so I do a pretty good job of not joining things that I don't think I can handle. But when I do commit, I'm all in. And that's when I have a hard time saying no. I'm on a couple of boards and, I'm always finding myself on their subcommittees and on the executive committee. And because I feel like if I'm going to do it, I should do it. I need to be as involved as I can. That I'm not there just to add it to my resume.
All right. Well, I'd hire you. So given those are your values, what kind of goals have you made along those lines? So do you have any goals that, that kind of stack on top of the values of honesty, valuing your own and everyone else's time, and I guess perseverance?
So my goals are a little loose. I don't have any, you know, real goals for growing my business and that sort of thing. My goal is to not overload myself to the point where I cannot fulfill those values for all of my customers, whether it be, you know, my direct customers or the people for whom I'm subcontracting. You know, I don't want to take on so much work that I cannot give them the very best that I have. But at the same time, you know, I am married to someone who has a regular 9-to-5 job, except when he's on call. And, you know, I have a dog and I have aging parents and I have a lot of friends and a lot of interests. So I want to be really mindful of not overcommitting and to do my very best for everyone in my world, you know. So that goes from my business to my families to my friends, and that's my goal.
You had mentioned in the early part of the episode about a health scare that you had, mm-hmm. and how that kind of had you reassessing some things. Did that have any impact on, I guess, a change in your values or a reassessment of your goals?
What my health scare was, and it was breast cancer, it was serious. And I knew I had good friends. The interesting thing was I didn't realize how good. You know, you don't always understand. It also made me appreciate where I worked, because not everybody would have had the support that I got from the people at Scripps Networks. As far as what it did for my values and my goals, it made me understand that being there for people and fully there, it's a lot, goes back to what I said about wanting to give everybody the best of me for everything that I do. That's what I found, what I got from the people around me during my cancer fight, was that they were all in. They were not halfway. I needed to reevaluate the way that I communicated with people, both professionally and personally, and make sure that I was present and that I was all in with whatever I did. So it's definitely helped me become more focused on that part of my personality and that part of my communication with people and those values that I hold dear.
Yeah, I can't imagine going through that trial myself, and I'm very fortunate that I haven't had to deal with cancer personally. We've had a lot of family and friends that have been impacted by it. We thought we were going to lose you for a while there.
Well, I wouldn't go anywhere. I'm too stubborn for that. So,
which of your past experiences, back to your, you know, days on the farm, do you think is most responsible for forming these values and goals? What really contributed to this mindset the most?
Well, I've seen my daddy is, you know, everybody thinks their daddy's the best, right? So my daddy's the best. he works really hard. He's incredibly kind. He's incredibly stubborn. And he gives his all to everything he does. And, you know, I've seen that through my entire life, you know, while he was farming and the way he takes care of my mother now and the way he takes care of my sister and I when we'll let him. It's has been a lifelong lesson in how to treat other people. I don't always live up to it, but I try really hard to. So I think that that's been an influence as far as being dependable and mindful of people around you. Now, my mother is the one that never quits. She never quits. So, and she never let me quit. You know, I was never allowed to quit things just because I didn't want to do them anymore. I was always said, you started it, you have to finish it.
This sounds like one of those things where when you're a kid, you really don't appreciate it at all. It's super annoying. No. My parents suck. But now that you're an adult, you're like, they're awesome. I can't believe they did such a good job for me. And yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, my mother encouraged me to do a lot of different things, whether I wanted to or not. And once I started them, like I said, she wouldn't let me quit. You're right. I didn't appreciate it very much as a kid. But yeah, I look back now and I understand that made me into the person I am now.
So I know you've got some hobbies. I don't know if you're a hobby collector like I am, but I can recall interest. We've already talked about running, of course. And then you did a lot of work, and I think you're still involved to a degree with the Bijou. And then you've got the whole pet adoption thing, mm-hmm. and then mentoring. I don't know if those are all still active for you, but those are the things I kind of remember knowing about.
They are. I'm no longer on the Bijou's board of directors. I'm a member of their Friends program, and prior to COVID, I was there a lot. I still communicate with the folks who run the place, and I'm still invested in its future. I am still on the board of directors for Humans and Animals Learning Together, so that's still a continued passion of mine. We've had to suspend our program for the past year and a half, but we're starting back up in the fall. And then I've also joined the board of Girls Incorporated, the Knoxville chapter. The mentorship I was doing was basically through Scripps and Women in Telecommunications. And of course, since I'm not in telecommunications anymore, I'm no longer in that organization. But Girls Incorporated, Girls Inc., focuses on helping mostly underserved populations of young girls achieve. So to be bold, to be smart, you know, we focus a lot on STEM and encouraging girls to pursue academics in the STEM world. And though I'm not working directly with the girls in the program, it kind of helps scratch that itch of mentoring. And I think, you know, I've got a meeting with one of our staff next week to kind of talk about how I can lean in a little bit more in our community. I live in East Knoxville, and there's been some strife, to say the least, in 2021 in the young people's community there, and I do not know how to engage. And so I'm meeting with this lady who works for Girls Inc. and to learn a little bit more about what I can do as a resident of the area to help lessen the burden.
It sounds like Girls Inc. is in a lot of ways is there to kind of level the playing field between the indoctrination that boys get versus what girls get in our culture, in our schools, where for decades and decades, boys are encouraged to go STEM, to go heavy on the science and math, to be bold and assertive, to get given a job description to say, oh yeah, I can do most of that, I'm going to apply, versus, oh, I can't do everything in that job description, so I'm not going to apply, which is more typically what you would see in a girl's mindset, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's actually something that, you know, when I was mentoring college students through Scripps, I would tell them that. I said, you don't have to know everything to apply for a job. So you don't have to have experience in every little thing on there. So you just have to know how to apply what you know to what they need. And I think Girls Inc. does a lot of that as well. And I think it's that, you know, when I was going into school, I said I was going to be an accountant because I liked numbers. I said it never occurred to me that I could be an engineer because no one ever mentioned it to me. In hindsight, I think I would have been a great engineer. I think I would have liked it. I think I would have excelled. But it just wasn't anything that ever crossed my mind because it just wasn't something women really did back then. Now it's a little bit different. I mean, women still lag behind. And you just have to make it interesting for girls. I don't think that our education system tries to exclude women anymore in these areas. A lot of places are really trying to recruit women, but if you can't get the girls interested early, then you're not going to get them later. So that's one of the goals of Girls Inc. is to make sure that the girls in, you know, elementary, middle school especially, have some positive exposure to the STEM area and make it interesting for them.
And early on in their formative days, mm-hmm. so that they can build on that can-do mindset instead of having to kind of reverse course on a fairly static, fairly grown brain and try to retrain it, which is a lot harder. So do you think what kind of link do you think exists between hobbies and careers?
I think it depends on the person. I don't think that my hobbies necessarily are reflected in my career. I've always worked to support my hobbies.
There's the link right there.
There are a lot of people in this world who have really keen interests that they're able to turn into careers. I don't have those. You know, the things that I enjoy doing in my spare time are not things that people are going to pay me to do. I mean, I sometimes like to run. I do run, but no one's ever going to pay me to do it because I'm slow as a turtle. So, you know, I couldn't turn that into a career. So, I think that it's important to find some joy in your career, but it doesn't have to be your passion for you to find success.
Well said. So we're just about out of time. So I want to zoom out a little bit and ask two questions. You kind of began to address this just a moment ago. hindsight. So hindsight is 2020, right? So if you could go back, what major decision would you change and why? Maybe that's, you know, a role that you wouldn't have taken or one that you would have. Or maybe it's leaving school or going to school for something different, starting a business or pulling the plug on one. What would you go back and change?
I did mention the whole idea of engineering. I think I've talked to a lot of young people in the past years, over the years, especially in the past 5 or 6 years. And I have been impressed with how bold they are. You know, in my 20s, I was not sure of myself. I didn't know what I wanted. I flailed around a bit and I was afraid, you know, I was afraid to take chances and I wish that I had. I mean, I'm happy with my life and I'm happy with where I am, but I think things might have been a bit more interesting had I had a little more courage in my 20s and more faith in myself. It's mainly young women that I know who are in their 20s and early 30s. I mean, they're starting businesses and building businesses and really impressive. I just cannot believe that they are so, yeah. Sometimes we Gen Xers laugh at the participation trophies, how no one ever, you know, when you're a child, no one wins anything anymore. Right. Everybody gets a trophy. And we laugh at that. But honestly, I look at these women and I think, you know, maybe there's something to everybody getting a trophy and everybody being empowered to be as good as everyone else. And you're not rewarding one or two children over the group of 50. You know?
Well, maybe it's not so much tossing the places, first, second, third place, out with the bathwater. Maybe it's just taking a step forward, leaning in and saying, anyone who's done this at all has recognized value.
Right? Yes, right. You're right. I mean, I do think someone needs to win. You know, I've run 11 half marathons and, you know, I get a medal for finishing because, you know, it's an effort and you've committed a lot of time and
training
to
equipment,
it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't take away value of having people win.
Right.
You know, I think winning's a very important part of society. But I do think that there is some value to making everyone who's participating feel like their participation is appreciated, you know, and then it was actually a triumph for them to finish what they started.
So we all set our goals based on our sort of our current ability set, right? Mm-hmm. So if my goal is I just want to complete a 10K, mm-hmm. right? Because I've never done one. Well, that's great. But maybe in 5 years, maybe I'm in much better cardiovascular shape and my goal becomes I want to place in that 10K. That doesn't diminish my effort in either way, just because I have a different goal. It's just, it's relative to where I am. And for you listeners out there, we are now in the middle of a thunderstorm.
Yes, that's not my stomach.
These are not Foley effects. That is real thunder.
Yeah, so you know, talking about goals and setting achievable goals, I think is important too.
That's true. I'm definitely guilty of being overly aggressive in goal setting sometimes. And I'm going to go out and I'm going to do this amazing thing. I've never done it before, but I'm going to do this amazing thing in 3 months, right? Don't people usually take 2 years to practice? Yes, but I'm going to do it, right? Mm-hmm. Just biting off way too much and then disappointing myself and then burning out and then, you know, ultimately quitting that thing because I didn't have a mother over my shoulder saying don't quit. Well, so that's definitely a thing, is setting legitimate, you know, realistic goals.
I mean, stretch goals are good, but they shouldn't be break goals. So they can stretch you, but you sure don't want them to break.
And I think it's also good to have staggered goals. Like I can say my goal is to place in a 10K, but a secondary goal, a fallback goal, is finishing the damn thing. Mm-hmm. Right.
My goals for every race is don't die, finish, try not to be last. And my ultimate goal is to outlive everybody else who's racing so that I'll actually win a medal in my age group.
I love it.
If I'm the only one running, I'm going to be first place.
I mean, it's a little bit threatening because I probably will be in a race with you in the future. And now I'm going to be thinking, she kind of wants me to die first. Oh. So what is next for you? I mean, you're barely into this soul prop that you're running. Do you think that's going to be what you're doing until you retire? And you give yourself your own gold watch, or what's next for you?
Well, as you said, this has been 2.5 years that I've been doing this, and I'm certainly doing better this year than I did last. Well, my plan right now is to do something that looks like my current business until I don't have to do it anymore. Whether I'll be 65 and a while. And you know, if I can at that point quit, the dream is to be able to take my work on the road and perhaps travel or move somewhere different and work. It's one of the perks of working for yourself and working remotely is that you can do it from anywhere. Of course, Jay's, the husband's job doesn't allow that at the moment, but you know, eventually it may transition to completely virtual too. So maybe one day I just work from the beach of Belize.
Well, that's the dream. I started my current role as a UX designer for a software company, and I started a fully work from home job 8 months before the quarantine. So I was already doing this work from home thing, but I was doing it alone. Like the home was empty when I was here working, right? When the quarantine hit, suddenly I was working from home, but everyone else was living at home and playing at home and everything at home full time. Mm-hmm. So that was certainly a change even for me. But it's been interesting watching all my friends and colleagues and family get used to the new world order that we've been in the last year and a half.
Yeah.
And seeing the impacts downstream. And then kind of just reading the tea leaves on how that's going to impact the work world now and moving forward. One of the interesting phenomenons I've seen is that all the companies that said, okay, we're going to trust you guys to work from home. And then they realized, well, yeah, they're all actually doing their jobs, maybe even more so at home. Some of those made the mindset decision of, okay, we're going to go to default remote, right? Or to fully remote. And if it makes sense, then maybe, you know, if you want to come in, you can come in. Whereas other companies are pivoting back to the more old school traditional mindset of saying, oh, no, you have to be on site. Mm-hmm. You have to be in Los Angeles to work for this company who's based in Los Angeles, right?
Right.
And I think a trend we're going to see is a vicious cycle for the latter companies, where they're going to be excluded more and more from the higher tiers of talent. People that aren't willing to move, or people that know full well they can do a better job at home and expect that kind of flexibility. I mean, I'm certainly in that camp. I do the work from here, but I would never want to take a job where it's on site all the time anymore.
Right.
There's just no reason for it. So I think that's a trend we're going to have to pay attention to.
Yeah, it's going to be very interesting to see how this COVID quarantine is going to affect things. I think it's changed. He's changed the face of business forever.
We stay with Airbnb and have some business with Airbnb, and it was interesting to see how they reacted as a company. Mm-hmm. They lost 80% of their revenue overnight, practically, right? Because they had to make an early decision March of last year to effectively shut down a lot of their operations. A lot of their operations just stopped, period, because people stopped traveling. But then the impact was regionalized, so people that were... This is actually a great area to talk about because the Great Smoky Mountains are nearby. Mm-hmm. And so you saw people, instead of traveling to California or France from here in this area, they would simply drive up the road to the mountains, yeah. Right? And they'd stay at somebody's cabin here locally instead of driving across the country, right? Mm-hmm. Or flying, God forbid. And so Airbnb was quick to pivot and to sort of recognize and honor the change in circumstances and behavior that we were all experiencing. And I think companies that are really flexible and aware, self-aware as a company of who their customers and users are going to be able to ride this kind of upheaval out a lot more gracefully.
We rented a house early on, like in, I guess, May of last year, early on with the quarantine, in Rogersville, of all places. It was this old log house that had been moved onto the property. And I was talking to the lady who owned it. I think we rented through Airbnb. And she said, why are you coming to Rogersville? I said, well, we've been sitting around looking at the four walls of our house for the past 2 months. We thought we'd come look at the four walls of yours just for a change of scenery.
And it's funny, though, that this is an unexpressed human need that kind of, it was latent. We didn't really recognize it or realize it because we had so much variety in what we saw day to day. Suddenly, I just want to see somebody different.
Yes.
Or see something different. Mm-hmm. Oh, please.
Yes, absolutely.
Suddenly, that's worth the price of admission. That little bit of novelty. All right. Well, you've given us your time so graciously today. Before we sign off, if you like, you want to tell us how we can find you, if you want to call attention to any of the many causes that you're involved with, whatever platform that you'd like to promote, it's certainly a good opportunity to do that.
Well, you can find me on LinkedIn and Facebook, Jay Gause Digital. I also have a website, which is jgausedigital.com. And Gause is spelled G-A-U-S-E. And the two charities with which I work are Humans and Animals Learning Together. We are
HALT.
HALT. Yes, HALT. And we rescue dogs from the pound, match them with groups of at-risk teenagers. The teenagers... teach the dogs basic obedience, and we find the dogs' homes. And that will take place in September. So if you're looking for a partially trained dog to bring into your family, look for us on the weekends. You can find us at haltdogs.org online, and we're also on Facebook. And then Girls Inc., we have an event coming up later this summer at the new Dick's Sporting Goods at Westtown Mall. And there are no details out there right now, but hopefully that will come to fruition pretty soon.
Good deal. Well, if you want, when you find out about the event details, let me know and I can update the show notes to include that information.
Great.
All right. Well, speaking of listeners, to you folks out there, the only thing I ask is if you enjoyed the episode, if you like this kind of chatter about the ways we end up in our roles, please leave a review on whatever platform you're listening to, if that's iTunes or Spotify or Google. If you feel so inclined, like us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Every bit helps. Thanks so much, and until next time, stay focused on your why.